Thanks for the invitation to speak. When the email came from Selina Luca asking me to give a talk, and my initial response is, I'm not sure I can bring anything that is of use for you. But then time and again, we found ourselves in corners at PI discussing things that were at the interface of what people typically working with the kind of questions that they have been discussed so far. And some things related to other type of our corners of motivations and what led us into following a lot of the work that has been have been done, presented by people in the audience, and taking it in a different direction. And I'll try to describe that. So first I'll give you a motivation, what and why brought us into this camp. It has to do with a conjecture, and I'll let you know where it come from. Then that led us immediately to talk about Carolian hydrodynamics and comparing and contrasting what horizons, and then we end up with a whole bunch of open questions, but maybe some interesting things along the way. So my main motivation, if you want, is resuming these two pictures. The first one is gravitational waves. So we, of course, you've known now even detections and numerical simulations show that the merger of two black holes, well, when they are sufficiently far apart, there is a very simple looking in spiral sinusoidal function that increases in amplitude and frequency as the orbit gets tighter. Eventually, when they merge, well, a black hole decays to equilibrium. And in between, there is a supposedly very complicated merger, but once you look at the waveforms, they are very, very simple. So you would argue, or you would wonder what's going on here, given that we're actually colliding at two things of order one. There is a lot of energy pumped into the system. There are many nonlinearities contained in the equations of motions. Where is that going? Why is it that these things are so simple? The other observation is hydrodynamics. The behavior of hydrodynamics and inverse fortunately, we just got reminded very recently that hydrodynamics describing the atmosphere tells us that these kind of structures show up, which are very, very long scales. Even though our typical intuition of turbulence is that, okay, you may form a swirl by just stirring the coffee in your cup, this will break into smaller swirls and this thing keeps continuing and energy goes down to smaller and smaller scales, so it's going to the UV, and there's a celebrated Kolmogorov scaling that is underlying the statistical description of the fluid flow. How do you get to this that actually is pumping energy to the long wave regime? And that has to do with a conserved quantity or a quasi-conserved quantity in fluid dynamics that is called entropy. And I'll say a few more things afterwards. And the reason you end up with this very long structure is at some point the height of the atmosphere is irrelevant with respect to latitude and longitudes. And the initial 3 plus 1 intuition has to transition to 2 plus 1. Which is where this entropy is taking you. So I'll say a few more words on that. So just ripped off of Wikipedia, if you've never seen what the entropy is, well, the first time I encounter it, to me, is just entropy with an H stuck in there. But it just is a measure of the amount of vorticity that your field has or your fluid flow has square. Out of that, you compute an energy. And if you're thinking in the incompressible case for the case of for concreteness, then you have, that's the definition. But when you ask what is the rate of change of the energy associated with the fluid velocity, the each change is tied to the this entropy in the following way. So in the case of this V is the viscous parameters. So in the case of a perfect fluid, that goes to zero, and it says there is a quantity that's conserved, an extra quantity that's conserved. And that changes the Kolmogorov scaling in a very significant manner. So if you're imagining that you're pumping energy in your fluid or in your flow at this scale, the -5/3 happens to longer scales to the left of it, and to the right of it, there is this direct entropy cascade that is much steeper. So as a result, there is a lot less energy moved into the UV as opposed to the IR. So that's something on the side. On one side, you put in a bucket. On the other one, well, we've known for a long time from the time of the membrane paradigm that there was this dual maybe at face value and optimistic duality between hydrodynamics and the behavior of gravity. But that was brought into a much firmer footing by the motivation through ADS-CFT of a fluid gravity correspondence, which is there even if tomorrow someone were to prove that ADS-CFT is complete crap. The fluid gravity correspondence is robust, can be derived directly from Einstein's equations by taking the proper limit to the ADS boundary on this side. So pick from that, we said, okay, maybe we can revisit this entropy and how the behavior of gravity and this fluid that is motivated on the boundary is like. And this is just an example of simulations. On the left-hand side, you have a simulation done in the context of ADS. So this is gravity in ADS. You put a black hole in the middle. You put some perturbations, some gravitational waves. And then you measure at the boundary what the stress energy tensor is doing. And in particular, this is the vorticity field of the associated fluid that lives on the boundary. On the right-hand side, what you have is, using the dictionary, evolving the hydrodynamics on that is dual to what's going on in the bulk, and I mean the qualitative similarities of these two examples are striking. This was just adding more, kind of, if you want, practical illustration of this duality between fluid and gravity. But more interesting was to try and say, okay, do we have a behavior akin to the vorticity? After all, the Kolmogorov scaling is something that we know in the context of Newtonian hydrodynamics. You actually lose contact with it once you go to the relativistic regime because now you lose dimensions. You can derive Kolmogorov scaling very easily by dimensional arguments, but once you go to the relativistic regime, length and time are the same thing, and so what can you derive? It's not clear. But you can dig deep, and this is what we need, and find that, well, there is a quantity related to the vorticity of your fluid flow that you can prove in the case of the perfect fluid is conserved, and it is this quantity. And if you consider now a viscous relativistic fluid flow, this quantity will vary slowly, proportional to the viscosity of your system. So that already hinted, well, there is a quantity like that, and maybe it is affecting things on the fluid flow. So what I have here is just two movies for you. This is, again, looking at the vorticity and asking the question, this is 2+1 hydrodynamics, just a second. This is 2+1 hydrodynamics, one dual to the Kerr ADS, and you're evolving the hydrodynamics on that front. This one is dual to Schwarzschild ADS on the Poincaré patch. In both cases, the movies are showing the vorticity, and you're asking what's going to be the end goal or what's going to be the end behavior of a dynamical system that has been perturbed with a particular fluid flow. And what you can see here is initially you had lots of small vortices that started merging and getting to create a larger and larger one, and the same thing happens on this side. So in both cases, you see that the fluid really wants to cascade in the opposite direction. So Lauren, you had a question.
Wait for a moment, Lauren. Sorry, you take it?
Just you define the vorticity, but you define A, it's the acceleration.
So that's the acceleration of the fluid velocity. Sorry, thank you.
At which order are you in the bulk perturbative expansion?
Say again?
At which order are you in the gravitational perturbative expansion?
Up to second order.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. And that's actually a very interesting question because another side comment there, and this is on the partial differential equations. Once you study relativistic hydrodynamics up to any order that has any viscosity, the equations of motion, the underlying equations of motions, are mathematically sick. Every order that you add corrects a problem that you had in previous orders, but brings new ones. And if there was the hope that, in some sense, GR, or general relativity pull to the boundary, is there is some relativistic hydrodynamics to infinite orders. But that's a side comment. Okay, so this was that. Okay, so that was the part of the story. So I I said that maybe there is a way to try and understand the simplicity of waveforms by perhaps a quantity that we have yet to identify that in gravity plays some constraint of where the energy should or how the energy should flow. We first connected gravity to anti de Sitter through the fluid gravity correspondence and saw there that indeed the fluid is behaving in a way that would seem to say that in 2 plus 1 hydrodynamics, which is the 3 plus 1 dual of gravity, in the context of ADS, things were indeed behaving kind of in the support of that idea that maybe there is a quantity on the gravitational size. But of course, that's not ADS. And as we heard Mark yesterday say, well, ADS is quite special in the way the perturbative dynamics plays out, that there is only a few kind of leading order contributions that uniquely determine everything that goes beyond that. So that would be an argument to say, well, ADS is very special. Maybe we wouldn't have this in the context of asymptotic flat space time. But on the other hand, if I put my PDE hat, it would say, well, I answer the questions when I add a cosmological constant. It's just a lower order term. It really doesn't affect anything as far as a nonlinear interaction in any significant manner. And that's, I'm stretching a little bit that statement, but we'll see in a bit what it is in more precise terms. But then what we try and do is to do a calculation, a bona fide calculation in asymptotic flat spacetime, and try to see if we can identify a process that is nonlinear in nature and indeed is describing this kind of phenomena of energy wanted to go to longer wavelengths as opposed to shorter wavelengths. So what we did, and this was work with Huang Yang and Aaron Zimmerman a few years ago, is to study a black hole spacetime that has been perturbed by some mode, let's call it H1. That mode, I mean, typically people study that by saying, well, we're going to keep studying, the Tarkovsky equation, if you know what it is, and then there is a source in the right-hand side that is given by this original mode. But in reality, the calculation that you want to do is to say that mode that is propagating over my spacetime is back reacting on the metric, is changing it, is giving it some small time dependence, and is a combined wave operator acting on another mode that you should be studying. And if you do that, if you study that in detail, what you find out is there are solutions to the problem of how this extra mode, extra field would behave that have this time dependence. So there is, of course, a decaying component that has to do with the decaying of your spacetime, but there is a potential contribution that it could be sufficiently large so as to, at least for some intermediate stage, throw in some mode that begins to grow exponentially. So this is a parametric instability, and then you ask for the conditions for that parametric instability to turn on, and then this is just math, it doesn't matter what it is, but I can tell you what the punchline that you can find is. The punchline is the following: if that mode had whatever L number, but azimuthal number half of that of the driving mode, of the original mode, then you get energy from the original mode and put it onto yourself. The condition for the parametric instability basically is given by that. There is a number, let's call it for, of course, obvious reason, RE for Reynolds, underscore G for gravity, so it's gravitational Reynolds number. It's given by the strength of the initial perturbation divided by the azimuthal number divided by the decay rate of that mode. And if you make this large enough, the parametric instability turns off. And then you can just say, well, I mean, I can use a very simple dictionary just by simple arguments. H would be, if I'm thinking of fluids, like the velocity. M is 1 over the azimuthal number, though that's like a wavelength. And this decay, that's like viscosity over density. And if you put these things, you end up with exactly what you know as Reynolds number in fluid dynamics. And this is just an example. If you had a black hole that for whatever reason is spinning extremely fast, and the reason you would pick this extremely fast is the case, it is because in that regime, the decay to equilibrium with black hole is the slowest. And if it is the slowest, or it is very slow, then nonlinearities have some non-trivial amount of time to do their magic. And this is what it's showing. This is the original mode. And some modes are sucking energy from these and growing for a while until we begin to decay. So while in the laminar regime, if you had done this just a linear order, you would have expected if you perturbed your kind of your black hole with this kind of structure, it will remain like so and slowly decaying away. In because of this instability, you end up with a much, much richer structure. And we're going to try and make contact with this again in just a bit. So this is very much work in progress. It's an outgrowth of the master thesis of Jaime Redondo Yuste, who just finished his master here at PSI, and now he's at the Niels Bohr Institute. Part of his work, when he came to me and said, do you have a project for me? I said, well, let's just find out what these guys are talking about. So then we started reading papers by all these authors, many of you being in the audience. And we were going back to our original conjecture, that original conjecture that said, well, maybe there is a dual of the behavior in fluids that we can draw some intuition on the gravitational side. We couldn't use the memory paradigm because that was on a time-like surface that is ambiguous, and so what someone called physics, someone else might call gauge. We couldn't use, in some sense, the ADS fluid gravity correspondence because that's at infinity, and that's the boundary of ADS is special with respect to asymptotic flat spacetime. So, but there is this new Carolian way of looking at the limit of that time-like surface and rigorously attach it to a null surface, which is the horizon. Let's try and make contact with that. And if we can do that, then maybe there's something interesting we can explore. So we were just essentially following your work. We set up our main surface of interest is a null surface that is expanding. Asymptotically, of course, we're going to hope or we're going to ask that this surface is corresponds to horizon, so this expansion should go to zero. We write the metric kind of around that null surface and postulate some behavior of that surface. And Einstein's equations, a subset of Einstein's equations, is, well, the so-called the Reich-Chowdhury equation and the so-called Damour equations. And I'm just changing notation. H happens to be just one half of this U. So if in the absence of anything interesting going on, I have a lot of freedom. I can choose any U that I want because these are just, in some sense, the shifts along my null surfaces and how I label coordinates there. And similar sum of that K. But of course, if there is gravitational waves that will go in, that will give us some dynamics, and then we have to be careful how to interpret what we do with that next. But just sitting with these two equations and looking at the Carolian hydrodynamics equations, well, you end up with, okay, this is the structure of these are the Carolian hydro equations, which you know much better than I do. And then you can try and do what's a dictionary that will take these equations into those. And of course, that's a very simple exercise. And you end up with this. And of course, here is the first ambiguity. There is an ambiguity of sign change. So in some cases, you can choose E to be the diverging of the vector that is tangent to the null surface, or you can choose the opposite. And if you do that, the pressure becomes plus this kappa, which is that thing that is sitting right there. We're choosing this convention for now, but I'll say a few more things as we go along. Kind of viscous contribution of the Carolian, or the viscous information of the Carolian fluid is contained in this tensor, which you can relate through both the shear and the expansion with these coefficients. So there is both bulk viscosity and shear viscosity. Some other authors have chosen a different convention where the bulk viscosity is actually shoved in into the definition of pressure. Physical reasons, I think that's not what I'd like to do. I mean, viscosity, so we have a fluid here that loses energy in more than one way. Some ways is just to try to smooth itself out. Other is contained by the fact that the surface is expanding, so some of that energy is kind of lost or diluted as the volume increases. This part of it is given by that coefficient, and so I prefer to have it there. But as far as the discussion is concerned, you can choose it wherever you want. But then we want to know, okay, let me just go back. So if I look at these equations, these are the hydro equations from or reinterpret or given in terms of geometric quantities. And from now on, for a while, I'm just going to stay at the geometric level. But these equations to me, or to us, cannot be analyzed in vacuum. And that's not, there is no pun there. I mean, we're in vacuum, but they cannot be analyzed just by that, because there are sources or there are pieces here that have yet to be determined. The behavior of this kappa, which of course is related to the pressure as we defined, and how is the behavior of the shear of that surface, of the null surface. So we're going to do an exercise. We're going to think that this horizon or this surface is not in isolation. Some gravitational wave will come through and we'll analyze it. But the very first thing I'm going to say is this picture that I've seen in several papers is, for me, very wrong. This is not, this has nothing to do with the equations that I'm writing here on the right. Because here on the right is our equations for a horizon. This theta, the expansion, is something that is smooth. I don't have the luxury of breaking it this way. Moreover, a horizon does not have a expansion that asymptotically goes to zero, and it could go to zero again at earliest times. I mean, in reality, the picture that we should be looking at is the following. One day it's going to show up. Okay, that's the one. So you have a surface that has some initial non-trivial expansion, and eventually might expand for as long as it wants, but asymptotically you would want this to turn around and go to zero, and this is a part of these teleological properties of black holes. So how are we going to analyze that? We're going to say, because this surface does not behave just independent of what's going on with the bulk of the spacetime, we're going to have to make contact with what's happening orthogonal to it. And that's contained in the R2 equation that are not contained here. The trace of the angular part of Einstein's equation and the trace free part. So if you add that and work to a perturbative order, the first thing you can do is just obtain, bring in this calculation what the expansion of the R direction is doing and the shear of the R direction, which will come in that source. We're also choosing the intrinsic metric, which has part of it which is pure gauge, so we're calling it C. But this C, for a little bit, is pure gauge. Once the gravitational wave crosses, it will acquire a little bit of dynamics that knows about the gauge I've chosen, but also the gravitational waves that are crossing. And in the lambda, which is the piece of the surface of, I mean, piece of the angular part of the metric of the null surface, again, I'm going to have a little piece there, which is going to kind of registering for that for us what the gravitational waves are doing as they come through. Once you put everything together, you can actually solve, and I'm not going to give it to you, but if you want, we have the expressions. What you find out is that this kappa and the shear can be written in terms of this U or this Hajicek H vector, the gauge and physics C, the physics S, and the expansion. And an evolution equation for the C. This is why I was saying there is a constraint that the C will have to satisfy. Part of it is gauge, part of it is physics. And if you take the effort of working that out and replace it in here, I'm going to look at this equation for a purpose that will come clear in a second. When you put all that together, you end up with this kind of a structure. So you have H dot equal to, let's look at the first line. The first line, first it has this minus the divergence times itself. So this is a decaying exponential. So this is an artifact or a consequence of the fact that we have a fluid whose fluid velocity will decay away if we make this volume grow or this surface grow. We also have Laplacian of itself, and this is very reminiscent of what we already have in Navier-Stokes. So in Navier-Stokes, the equation of the motion, not for simplicity, let's consider the incompressible case. You have the time derivative of the velocities is U times the derivative of the velocities. And then there is something called the second derivative, the Laplacian of the velocity. So that's these are the pieces that are coming in here. And then these type of pieces are here. And then there are some sources that have to do how.
Sorry, Luis, just yes. To be sure I understand. Can you go back to the previous
yes.
slide? Yeah, so you're making this expansion. And then the epsilon, you would. Why doesn't show up at the end in your equations?
We're carrying things all the way to epsilon. And so this will show up. Yeah, I mean, the epsilon is hidden somewhere in there.
Okay. And the power of epsilon, how do
We're carrying to leading order in that epsilon.
Yes. And you know that it, there would, could you have other powers? You see, in the U or the omega or the lambda, that the subleading all go with the same power of epsilon. Is it?
So we throw in the leading power, yeah, and then carry up to that power, and then if something is not of that order, it evaluates to zero. It has a contribution of epsilon squared. So things like what comes in here, we
and
just keep
and
track of all these orders.
And then there, but this is n a b n. What is that?
This n. So they don't show up here because these show up in the R2 equations. So if you write the trace of the angular part of Einstein's equation and the trace free part, all these terms come in.
Exactly. Thanks.
So what do we gain with this? Well, the first thing, and I'm going to go back to being very liberal with dimensions, just as you do the calculation, so on the Reynolds number. So let me go back first. So if I ask you to derive the Reynolds number, the typical Reynolds number in fluid dynamics, what you do is you come in here, you just look at this, and you simply ask, when is this term larger than that term? And you use that, the fact that, okay, d squared is like 1 over l squared of u, this is like 1 over l of u, where l is your typical wavelength that you're thinking about. So if you liberally play with that same argument in this equation, you end up with a definition for what would be your Reynolds number for this equation that goes in this form. So it's your h, so imagine the velocity times the wavelength that you're thinking about, divided by this, lambda squared theta plus 1. So the difference with the Navier-Stokes case is that you wouldn't have this piece, but now you do. So you recall that for having some interesting nonlinear dynamics, you would like this number to be as large as possible. So it's actually hinting that to get to a regime where nonlinearities will channel things, well, might be tough because this thing can be fighting against you. In the standard Reynolds number argument, you'd say, well, I can always choose lambda as large as I want. So I can have a very small fluid flow going through, but it has a very long wavelength. That will have a large Reynolds number. So I can have turbulence in very long wavelengths and not short wavelengths. But here, these pieces will be working against. So you have to be careful. But of course, this was all kind of hand-waving. And for concreteness, it's better to just go to look at simulations carefully. Laurent?
Maybe a few questions about, because you went fast on the... So the UDU term, they look a little bit different than the usual ones.
This right? one? So,
Could you?
This is for incompressible. Usually you have these two terms, for instance. These two terms, you have it in Navier-Stokes.
Yes, exactly. So is there something different in this velocity, exactly because it's Carolean, or that was the question?
Well, okay, let's see. I don't know the answer to that question. So I tell you, let me just correct. So these two terms are the typical ones. So this would be the next one. So this would be the new one. But okay. I haven't been digging too much into the structure of Carolean versus this one.
Okay. And what about what you mentioned earlier, the negative bulk viscosity? Somehow this gets resolved, or is it still
there?
No,
it's still there.
Okay.
So
good.
Very interesting. Yeah. It maps onto one-to-one to what the memory pattern has found, up to that choice of sign that maybe we'll comment on that at the end.
And how does it show up in your Lorentz? Does that infer the next discussion?
Say again?
This negative bulk viscosity, does it play a role in the discussion about the Lorentz, the Reynolds number?
Yeah, so if you actually look at this in detail, this actually shows up, and we have it in the paper, but yeah, it's subtle there.
Louis, the lambda in the Reynolds number, what is that? Is it coming from the lambda AB? No,
that lambda is... If you want to take this equation,
yeah,
and the gradient of u scales like u over lambda. So it's like per wavelength. You're analyzing that equation per wavelength. And then you say, for that wavelength, is this term dominating over that one? And as I said before, you can do this in the Navier-Stokes case because you have access to these dimensions. In the relativistic case, you don't. So I'm playing very liberally there. Okay. That's why we then said, okay, the only way to kind of make contact with this is to actually study this system of equations with, of course, these constraints that you are derived numerically. You just write a code, and then ask the question, what happens? And given a perturbation that goes through your wave, through your surface. And that's this. So in here, what you have in the left, I should explain. So the top is, so what you have is initially it's a gravitational wave. So imagine it's a gravitational wave. This is your surface. And the experiment is like so. There is a gravitational wave, and the gravitational wave contacts L2, M2, and L3. So you have a source that has carried those two kind of L numbers. And then you compute for many Ls, so this is just being careful numerically, for the strength of this gravitational wave, what the content per mode is of the energy. So, and you start the simulation at future, at infinity if you want, and then you backtrack it. So initially, you only have energy in some modes. So initially you have no energy because you're coming from here. And then you pick up the source that comes in, but and then you go as early as you can for a while. So if the initial perturbation is sufficiently small, the content of the higher Ls is very small. It's subleading. You haven't excited anything interesting there. But just changing that initial energy or that energy of the gravitational a little bit more, you can see that qualitatively things change. And now some of the modes that in this top plot essentially had nothing, here they're beginning to turn around and grow. So you end up with a structure that is much richer, and this is a kind of a manifestation of energy being moved away from some modes into the narrow modes. And here is the same thing for the vorticity. So if the initial perturbation, if the gravitational wave perturbation is weak, you have something that is not exciting anything, while for stronger perturbations, now all the energies are actually much more kind of distributed. And this plot is perhaps nicer. This is, you start here, and you go to the back, and then you ask, show me kind of an isometric embedding of the surface of each case one at early times with different initial content or amplitudes for your initial perturbation. So this is reminiscent to what I had shown before. It's just hinting that, yes, in the right regime, there is nonlinear interactions. These interactions are moving energy one way or another. We still need to study or get to what we really wanted to go, which is to try and identify what this entropy quantity might be and what its kind of role or what its expression on the gravitational side is and what we can do with it. So this is where we are now. We have more questions than answers. I mean, we have sufficiently tantalizing signs that this is a productive kind of venue to keep looking, but there are things also that don't necessarily jive or bug me at night. So this choice of negative pressure versus negative energy by just choosing a sign is not trivial. A choice, if we choose negative pressure, we actually end up landing with something that looks like we have negative entropy, and I have no idea what that means. So if we go sufficiently forward in the future, the energy, remember, was the divergence of our null surface, because that goes to zero, and our pressure will still be negative. So what the heck is that? I don't know how to interpret the right-hand side. Maybe then the choice is to choose negative energy, and I don't know what that is. If I'm an observer, when do I measure negative energy? On the other hand, that will solve the entropy thing. Is that telling us something about the connection with the microscopic behavior of the system? I have no idea. We need to make sharper, and this goes to your question as to what's the role of the bulk viscosity. Try to make sharper the distinction of the high Reynolds number regime, and then try and see if we can kind of point to where would be interesting corners of the parameter space to look for non-simple behavior in the waveforms. Another interesting thing is the message for any other null surface. So this was a null surface that corresponded to the horizon, but there was nothing special with that. The only special thing was to choose that asymptotically this equation evolved to a regime where theta goes to zero. But any R surface which can be equally well determined by this kind of analysis. And going back to this would be telling us that the dissipation rate of this fluid velocity is much higher. So we're kind of, that surface wants to get rid of its structure much more efficiently. And so it's interesting to try and map out what does it mean geometrically for the full spacetime, and perhaps connect in a different way with how rapid the system, seen asymptotically, sheds off its structure. But with that, I think these are all questions I have, and I'm trying to, well, we're trying to grapple with them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Luis, there are questions. We go through them. First of all, let me just also thank you for coming to our community and try to approach us with your perspective and make the effort to link. We really appreciate that. And we take questions. Charles, go ahead.
And don't eat up on lunch time.
So, can we go back to the plot with the sort of like...
The which one?
This one. I'm sorry, I did not understand the plot. So you said it was the power spectrum.
Take the energy. So you take your theta. Sorry, I wasn't clear. You take your theta that you have evolved, and you ask how much energy do I have in theta per mode. So each L has a bunch of M's associated with it, of course. You add up all the energy per L, and then you just plot that. So the question is, given that you only excite L equal 2 and L equal 3 through your perturbation, through your waveform that is coming through, what's the behavior of all of them?
Okay.
So again, these, and I hate that word, but teleological seems to be the word that people use. I cannot pronounce it. But I mean, because it's this of the property of the horizon, I mean, earlier on, it knows what is going to come. And so it decides to have a content depending on that, if you want to think of this way. So we're, and the message is, look, you're perturbing with some strength here. And depending on that, then the content here is far richer in the what you would call the high Reynolds number regime than what it is in the laminar regime.
And the axis there, V?
That's just time. It's the time measured by this observer. So at late times, everything is decaying to zero, as it should, because the energy should go to zero. But at early times, it has this structure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I have a question about something you mentioned at the end about going away from horizons. So maybe you kind of answered it, maybe, but could you elaborate more? It's more like, you know, do you see a difference between the physics of a trapped, you know, null surface versus non-trapped?
Right.
Right. So you're saying the non-trapped is going to dissipate more, and the trapped is, I mean, could you comment on what you expect difference of physics to be?
No, it's just so if I'm an observer, if I'm an null observer, then I'm writing different things of this. Okay, let me backtrack a little bit. So in the context of if I go all the way to the beginning, first it was the beginning. In the context of gravitational waves, it's amazing how many hand-waving explanations people have put up to explain for that simplicity. So one relies on saying, oh, if you're sufficiently close to the nonlinear, to the black holes, somehow the nonlinearities end up trapped there. Something that is odd. But on the other hand, if you want to use this kind of intuition, you say, well, if I'm just looking at the null surfaces that are coming out, of course, the waveforms are riding on them, right? And it looks like the ones that are marginally trapped, the horizon, keeps its structure for quite a bit. Of course, it's dissipating it. But the one that is next door that will diverge will shed it or want to smooth it up much more efficiently than this R one. And of course, you can also ask, well, what happens with the null surface that is inside? Okay, that one acquires a lot more structure. And who knows, that might be related to trying to make contact with mass inflations and things like that. But it's interesting to think about this dichotomy of behaviors.
please.
Thanks. Do you have any prospect on seeing this Carlian fluid from black hole imaging shadows? What is your
Interesting question. No, I don't think so. But because the black hole, okay, colleagues might disagree, of course, and I have the reputation of being cantankerous, so I have to keep it. No, so the Event Horizon Telescope does not see the event horizon. They might want to say that, oh, I'm going to be killed now, but it mainly sees is a surface that is close. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing, if you want, it might be this null surface that has some structure. So, but it's the strength of which you could see
but
something.
But if we were to probe a bit further away until the, say, photon sphere or something.
So yeah. Right. So then you might see some, again, these things are photons are riding on null surfaces. And so you might say, well, if you are sufficiently exciting the black hole structure, you might see something. But I mean, I'm trying to be as optimistic as I can. So I don't think so. But
thanks.
All right. Other questions for Luis? Okay. Well, if not, well, let's thank him again.